So I want to share a complimentary talk with a lovely talk that Linda offered, kind of about the theme of, despite it all, finding happiness in 2025. And I'm going to share a little bit of history about the realities of the Buddha's life. I think maybe the way I come at it, it's a little bit conditioned because I was a journalist for 35 years and kind of in the middle of it, stuff. So it brings me a certain way of seeing things. But the primary thing that Lindell touched on too is that the Buddha taught one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And for those of you who don't know, dukkha is the proper Pali word for suffering because it means a lot more than we think of it as at first, we Westerners. And so it's a key to this is discerning the difference between pain and suffering. In life, in human life, we all experience pain. You know, things we like go away, things we didn't like arrive. Even if things are completely hunky-dory, we get old, we get sick, we die. All that stuff happens. But suffering doesn't have to happen. Suffering's optional. That's what the Buddha realized, lived, and taught. So his life, the Buddha's life, was not devoid of pain. And this is relevant in terms of whatever seems gnarly to y'all in 2015, that his circumstances, especially during his 40 years of teaching, had all kinds of pain and problems. It's actually amazing. And arguably worse than anything any of us are experiencing now. So you think of the Buddha and it's like, oh, you know, crystal spheres hanging from trees and daffodils and peacocks. It wasn't like that at all. It was pretty rough. So he experienced pain, but because he had attained nibbana, he didn't suffer. And that's the critical, really, in a sense, the core message here, because maybe we're going to experience some pain in 2025 for political reasons, for any kind of a reason, but we don't have to suffer. Or it's incremental. You know, the Buddha, he achieved nibbana, so he crossed the threshold, so he didn't suffer at all. But for us, there's a way in which practice can move us in that direction. So we'll be freer of suffering despite unpreferred pain. Here's a short list of the pain he experienced. And I've done a lot of research on this has been a fascinating area for me. So, his two primary lay mentors and friends, King Bimbisara and King Pasenadi, they're both kings, took king the kingdoms, his territory, Buddha's territory is about 300 miles up and down the Ganges Valley, and two major kingdoms occupied that space. There was no such thing as India then. Both of those kings were overthrown, coup d'états, by their own sons who killed them. During the Buddha's lifetime, those were his best friends. They both got killed. Bimbisara starved to death in a right near the bamboo grove. I've been there. Starved to death, right? Like the Buddha was alive, starving to death right there in front of his eyes. King Virukanda, he attacked and destroyed the Sakya clan, Buddha's family. This tribal family killed a bunch of his cousins, overran during his lifetime. So his home turf got run over and destroyed and invaded during his lifetime. Devadatta, one of his cousins, one of the Buddha's cousins, during Buddha's entire life, was trying to kill him. Multiple attempts, a maddened elephant rolling a stone on him, hiring an assassin. Devadatta was trying to kill him and usurp his position as teacher. And we may have family problems, but can anyone match that? Right? And then during his 40 years, there was groups of monks and individuals, they rebelled against the teachings, they went AWOL, they did all kinds of stuff. And the Buddha himself, he had headaches, he had a bad back, he had stone splinters in his feet from the boulder that Devadatta rolled upon him. But the point is, this was a pretty gnarly life. And this happened, if you read the suttas, all this stuff was happening during the 40 years when the Buddha taught the most incredible deep dharma that's in the entire four Nikayas. When you think of it that way, it's like, oh my God, all this stuff is happening and he's sharing this unbelievable, splendid dharma in the middle of all that stuff. So it offers us how we can be in the middle of all this stuff. So we can experience pain and disagreement and conflict, but we don't have to suffer, and we still can benefit ourselves and others in terms of the Dharma. And so we don't have to think there's an either or. Pain happens, suffering is optional. And the Dharma path is about recognizing the difference. And, you know, we're not getting political, but I get it that people have pain across the entire political spectrum. I know a lot of people who think differently than I do. I won't say what that way is, but it's the way I think is as hard for them as the way they think is as hard for me. I get that. It's really worth opening our hearts and getting that. You may have family members who are all over the map in terms of where they're at. I have some very close family members, like really close, who think I am just completely wrong on a whole bunch of arenas. And there you go. Got to live in love. So it's just how it is. So there's this amazing moment. I love this sutta called the Raja Sutta, Udana 2.10, where King Pasenadi goes to visit the Buddha. There's a lot of amazing contacts between the Buddha and these kings in the suttas. But in this one, remember, the guy's a king. He's got a courtyard. He's got a court. He's got all these courtiers and rich people all maneuvering for power, all that stuff, all that samsaric stuff. And he has to wait for a little while. So he's watching. He's in this glade, and there's all these monks. And he kind of goes, oh, my God. He's kind of getting it, how different all these monks, who, by the way, have nothing. They have a robe, a bowl, a needle, a water strainer, three robes. That's it, and an umbrella. And speaking to the Buddha, the king says, I quote from the suttas a little bit, because it's good. Venerable sir, kings quarrel with kings, nobles with nobles, Brahmins with Brahmins, householders with householders, mother quarrels with child, child with mother, father with child, child with father, brother quarrels with brother, brother with sister, sister with brother, friend with friend, right? That's the train wreck of samsaric life. Doesn't seem much fun. But the king says, here, I see monastics living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Here I see monastics smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighting, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, subsisting on what others give, abiding with mind as aloof as a wild deer's. He's seeing a bunch of happy people who don't have anything. Isn't that cool? So what do we make of that? What can we learn from that in the middle of a painful time so that we can be happy like that? And, you know, I'm sure all of us are some of the time, but more of the time. Right? More of the time. And to be sure, you know, I'm not talking about being passive and not taking action to right wrongs. We can do whatever we're moved to do, politically, socially, whatever, but how we do it. We don't do it with divisiveness. We don't do it with hating others. We can improve things, take action, but do it in a way that lifts everybody. Then it's happy. And the Buddha, in fact, did speak up for the rights that he underprivileged, constantly spoke to the Brahmins about that your hereditary role as Brahmins, that's not really what makes you a good person. What makes you a good person is what you do, oh, by the way. He pushed back a lot. He tried to stop wars. He tried to stop wars between these kingdoms. He did stuff. But he did it with this vast understanding of emptiness, with his vast understanding of being past suffering. And he did it with limitless compassion for all sentient beings, both the victims and the perpetrators. You really start to get that when you read his suttas. Any person he ever encountered, he saw their possibility to awaken just like him. It's consistent. It's amazing. He never judges anyone. He never gets pissy at anyone. He just sees their possibility. So think, five great moral leaders of the 20th century. It's come to mean a lot to me in the Dharma. And I'll list Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Thich Nhat Hanh. Just those five, for instance. Extraordinary group of people. And in every case, they made big changes in society because of what they did, because of who they were. And in every case, they did it without demonizing others. It's really extraordinary. Look at Nelson Mandela. He's in prison for, what, 25 years? He did not demonize the others, nor did Martin Luther King, nor does the Dalai Lama. So it really is evidence to a way we can cultivate to proceed in the middle of a time when it's pretty tempting to demonize others. And a striking thing about all five of those, if you sort of look at their lives and tune into them and read their stuff, they were actually pretty happy people. Dalai Lama certainly is. You know, it may not like smiling, gleaming, that kind of happy, but there was a certain peace. Thich Nhat Hanh, certainly. Martin Luther King, certainly. They were beautiful, extraordinary, radiant. There was a certain kind of inner radiance of their kindness that was inescapable, that was consistent. Pretty amazing. And this is despite the fact of those five, every single one had significant oppression from a despotic regime. Every single one. Three of them were imprisoned. Two of them were assassinated. And they still had that kind of radiance. Dalai Lama is the only one still with us. So, conditions weren't easy, yet they experienced happiness and even joy, the theme of this retreat. And they did that while making differences in the world. So, you know, in our way, we can too. I love that. We can too. We can too. And I experienced this kind of radiance. I'm very fortunate. One of the good things about being old is I had a chance to start in the Dharma way back when there were great Tibetan masters who were still alive, who came out of Tibet in the 1959 diaspora. Dalai Lama is one of those, but there's not many left anymore. They got old. They died. But I can remember beings like, well, Venerable Genla Rinpa, who visited Seattle. I think Jordan remembers Genla, yeah. Geshe Darge, Kirti Sanchab Rinpoche, Lama Tarchin, Chagyo Tukul Rinpoche, all of these had experienced excruciating loss. Their country was taken over. Many of their colleagues died in prison. Most of the monasteries were torn down. 1 million Tibetans died during the Cultural Revolution. Incredible loss. And all of those had this radiance of happiness that they manifested. And it looked not like they'd forgotten what had happened, but they did. In the middle of all that, they did. It's amazing to watch. Really, it's inspired me, you know, even in the, you know, I've had some conversations in these groups about, you know, difficult times when things run dry during the dark nights of the soul. But you remember these people or read about them or look on, you know, YouTube and see them. And it really can remind us how we can have happiness in the midst of the train wreck of samsaric life, the 20th century, the 21st century. It's kind of not that different. So we can learn from them. And in this practice, that which emerges is a kind of radiance that can benefit others and really can be the greatest gift that we can offer is just manifesting that awakened mind. There's this key quote from the suttas that many of my friends here who've been around me a lot, that I'm always bringing up, and I've come to understand it just recently, part of why I always talk about it, I never hear any, I seldom once in a while hear anyone else say, because it's a bridge between the Mahayana part of my practice and the Theravada part of my practice, both of which are quite alive. But this is from, well, it's from the numerical and connected discourses. And it says, the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. The mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. This is beautiful summation of what the spiritual journey is. All of our minds are luminous, but there's stuff in the way. That's the path. We peel away the stuff, the luminosity reveals. So it has everything to do with these great beings we've been mentioning, and radiant, irrespective of difficult conditions, and everything to do with how we can navigate difficult conditions here in 2025, when sometimes it just seems like too much to bear. So it does like, seems like that to me sometimes. Climate change, oh my God. And yet, here we are. And, you know, in the context of worldly life and the consumer products machine of 2025, we are conditioned to seek out pleasant circumstance. We're told incessantly, that's what we got to do to be happy. And people have, you know, hypercars and giant yachts and all this stuff that people do to kind of make perfect conditions. And I'm sure they feel some pleasure for a little while, and then it ends. I mean, at least they get old and get sick and die. And sometimes when people, I've read a couple of stories in the New York Times just captured me, where I won't go into details, but essentially people who had a really, real cushy situation, either they inherited a ton of money or they had very lucrative situation, just everything was just coming up roses. They were beautiful. They were rich. Their friends were rich. Everything was good. And then something went wrong with that, and they couldn't maintain that. They just didn't know what to do. They couldn't, a couple of them just tried to hold it together, got themselves insanely in debt, and two people killed themselves. Two people like that. They shot themselves because they just couldn't, they couldn't be normal people anymore. They had to have that. How sad is that? So the five that I mentioned, they experienced pain, you know, just like the Buddha did, just like we do. But to varying degrees, they didn't suffer. And I'm not going to try to extrapolate Dharma practice onto Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King, although when you read the teachings of Martin Luther King, man, they sound a lot like the Dharma. He got it. I mean, he was a sacred being. He got it. It's not that different, right? So they experienced pain, but they didn't suffer. They didn't suffer because they didn't succumb to the concretization of self and other. And that's part of why they didn't demonize. Because it's easy to think that the people who we think are doing really bad stuff are somehow inherently evil. And everybody thinks that about everybody else on every side, every end of the political spectrum, right? And in terms of nationalistic wars, the whole deal, you know, Palestinians and Israelis, Russians and Ukrainians, North Koreans and South Koreans, it goes on and on. We tend to concretize the other, and they're the problem. So this kind of gets at, and the reason why I read that quote, is the incredible simplicity of the Dharma path. There are obscurations, our conditioning, our fears, maybe our karma, that block our innate nature of mind, block us from seeing it. We don't even know it's there. Our innate luminous mind, we walk through life, don't even know it's there, but it is. And it can be revealed. And it takes some work, it takes some practice, it takes some work, but it's there. So it's not like this process of awakening is conjuring up something or making something up or creating a really nice state of mind, kind of like we created ice cream. It's just pulling away the barriers. That's why it's so beautifully simple. There are barriers. We walk through them. We've had difficult childhoods, and you know, if you open up the possibility of rebirth, then it gets like really big, because God knows what we've done in former lifetimes. I've had some hits about my former lifetimes, and some of it was not too good. So, you know, here I am. Got to work through that stuff. So as we become aware of these obscurations and unwind the tangles, Buddha talked about tangles all the time, our grasping thins. It's like mist clearing. That's what mindfulness practice does. You know, you ever notice that when, especially, how many people have been on long retreat? Any? Few? Yeah, long retreat. Do you ever notice that, like, sort of the dumpster of your soul is revealed? Like, see, there you go. See, all this, the weird stuff that I remembered things that I did to my brother that I didn't even know that I did. until I was in long retreat. It was like, oh my God, I did that. You know, but it was in there. It conditioned me somehow. I had to go through it, had to see through it if this innate clear light nature of mind is going to emerge. So mindfulness practice, we moment by moment see all of our stuff. We see through it gradually. Whatever our tangles are, we see through it, and then things start to be freer. So anyone who isn't yet awakened is because this freedom is obscured. And each not yet awakened person has a unique set of conditions. And since they're conditioned, they all came from some cause. They don't come out of nowhere. There's causes and conditions over lifetimes, over this lifetime, a whole sequence of stuff. And when we think about others who seem difficult, whether they're despots, you know, political leaders who control many other persons for their own personal wealth. We know many people in the world who are like that, right? But they didn't come that way in a vacuum. Causes and conditions. Adolf Hitler. He had early traumas. His dear younger brother, who he's very close to, died of measles when Hitler was young. His mother died when he was young. He was left with his father, who was very oppressive and heavy-handed and wanted his son to be in government. But Adolf Hitler wanted to be an artist. He was butting heads with his dad because Adolf Hitler wanted to be an artist. He applied twice to the Academy of Fine Arts of Vienna and was rejected both times. He ended up being Adolf Hitler doing what we know he did. It's not like it's an excuse, but you kind of look at that and there's other stuff going on. It wasn't like there was this inherently evil person who popped out of his mother wanting to kill a million Jews. He was this guy who wanted to be an artist. And then all these things happened. It had something to do, a lot to do with who he was. So we can think about, you know, it's worth thinking when we understand what the process of growth is, then we can extrapolate that out to beings whom we may abhor their actions. But maybe we can not abhor them. Big difference. You know, big, hard to do. Our default is abhor them. But they're not the same. And so here in 2025, with difficult political situations, all the world, you know, we're so, I mean, even in my lifetime, you know, I was a functioning journalist before the internet. Does anybody remember before the internet, right? So there'd be like things called newspapers that came out once a day, and you'd read the news on this big piece of paper thing, and you didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world, and it was kind of far away. There wasn't YouTube, there wasn't the internet. You couldn't tell what was going on. You see the news sometimes, you know, on TV and stuff like that, but it was not like we're now in it together in a way that we never were. And it's almost just in this time. It's almost like, you know, the other two-edged sword thing. Here in 2025 is just in this time that the truth of not self, of emptiness, is really becoming real and tangibly helpful to us if we're going to navigate it. Because we start to realize we can't demonize anyone because there's no inherent anyone to demonize. That's part of what we see with emptiness, what we see with not self. There's no inherent anyone other to demonize. There's causes and conditions. There's a being. And in many cases, those beings, they actually think they're doing the best thing, maybe. And they're also greedy, maybe, whatever. But there's no inherent being to demonize. And because we're all stuck together in this world, it gets more vividly in our faces than it was back in the newspaper days. And just as an aside, you know, oh, by the way, gnarly those things were, I mean, I was born, and probably some other people, right after the Second World War. I mean, I grew up, the Second World War was in my face. We used to play Second World War games all the time when I was a kid. My dad lost his leg in the Pacific. He came back with a Bronze Heart and a Purple Star and then got caught by Joe McCarthy, supposedly, for doing nothing and, you know, destroyed his career, which he, I mean, anyway, all this stuff. So That was the world just about went this way or that way. You know, it's huge. It's worth keeping in mind when we feel, oh my God, this is so terrible. Remember the Second World War, First World War, Civil War, huge things, and kind of put a bigger frame around it. Okay. But to get back to our practice, you know, when we, what we learn from our mindfulness practice helps us learn about others' tangles, about others' contractions and blind spots. Because as I was, we were just saying, in our own practice, we encounter all of our flaws, right? All of our conditioning, everything that's stuck and negative, we see it sooner or later. We see ways that we were mean with people, we reacted, our fears, our pinch places, our moments of meanness, everything. We see it all, but that's okay because we're in a journey of awakening. And that's what we got to do to get free and to be kind and to be compassionate, is to go through it. And just when we see all these little bits, the other thing we see, because there's three characteristics, some of you know, three characteristics in Theravada practice of impermanence, anicca, anatta, not self, and dukkha. When we see these things arising and passing, and we see these qualities, we also see that they're not us. That is part of the, just in the moment of seeing, the freedom is happening. It's this continual opening. We see it's not us. So everything's conditioned, and therefore it's all changeable. And that's, you know, it's all changeable. And in terms of our own sphere, when this happens, when we start to see things have causes and conditions, when we see the freedom, we also start to develop compassion toward ourselves. Because people can be really down on themselves about their sticky bits. You ever notice? People are very self-critical. They think, oh, this is me, this quality I have, this is me, yuck, I hate it, I don't like me. And they get stuck there. But it's just things that arise and pass. But people get stuck there. To be free of that is a huge part of the journey, to see through it. An important thing to remember, that when the Buddha told us to cultivate mindfulness, he said to do it internally and externally. So we have this paying attention to our own stuff, but we can also pay attention to others' stuff. That's the externally part, one way of understanding that. And this gets important, because look at the Buddha, how he was during his 40 years of teaching. Because if you read his suttas, pretty much what they are is an encounter with someone, a discussion, not all, but a ton of what they are, is an encounter with someone, a discussion, sometimes even a debate. And often that person was arrogant, was in opposition, was trying to undermine him, all kinds of things. It's very interesting. And what he always did, the thing to me that's striking, is he always recognized the potential for each of those persons to become a Buddha. That's it. That's what he sees. Because he's a Buddha. He sees it in everybody else. They got this stuff, but he sees that potential to awaken. So here's a question for you. When you think of, say, the political person that you have the most problem with, do you think of their potential to be a Buddha? Yeah? Maybe not. How about if you do? I mean, that's really important. How about if you do? With the very person who's the most difficult, Adolf Hitler, whatever, think of their potential to be a Buddha. It changes everything. Because much of what's so painful is we're afraid that those evil ones are going to take us out and destroy our families and all this thing because they're evil or whatever. But they're just sentient beings with the possibility of awakening just like us. And this guy, really radical. Who's heard of the story of Angulimala? Ring a bell? A few people. Yeah, Angulimala. First historically known serial killer, by the way. And Angulimala, the name means, mala is a necklace. Anguli is a finger. He had a necklace of 999 fingers of persons he'd killed. He was on a roll. They probably really quite an advanced serial killer compared to, I mean, some of the ones we have, just like a few dozen people. He had 999 people he'd killed. How extraordinary. Fierce bandit with a great sword and very powerful in the jungles of India, terrifying people. He was on a roll. And the Buddha, we'll go into the whole story, kind of, but the Buddha had this instinct that somehow the time was ripe. And he went into the forest. And everyone's saying, no, don't go in the forest. You're going to get killed. I mean, the governor had sent big troops and they'd all been killed. Gaudiamala was something else. The Buddha just goes in the forest consciously brings his begging bowl. It's always striking. In the sutta, he brings his begging bowl. He'd already done alms around. He wasn't going to Gaudiamala for alms, but he kind of just brings his bowl and his robe and goes into the forest. Gaudiamala starts chasing him, and he somehow, here's the mystical part, can't seem to catch him. And he says, stop, Buddha, stop. And the Buddha says, no, you stop. And he gets it. Gaudiamala gets it and was, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. And he ends up becoming a monk. He ends up taking robes. He ends up becoming an arhat in his life, in that one lifetime, despite all that. How amazing. Far worse than probably your most dreaded political person. None of them have killed 999 people personally with their own personal killing device. So far worse. And he became an arhat in that lifetime. And the Buddha saw that he could, as he did with all beings. It was kind of a radical one, to be sure. There's a stupa in India to this day to Gaudiamala because he was an arhat. He awakened, just like we can. Pretty amazing. So he didn't see him as an inherently evil person, as everyone else in the region did. He saw his potential to awaken. Product of causes and conditions, making bad choices, whatever. But he saw his possibility. And so Gaudiamala stopped on many levels and became a monk. How many have heard of King Ashoka? King Ashoka? Yeah. King Ashoka, 200 years after the life of the Buddha, was perhaps the first emperor who unified India, but he did this through slaughter. He did this massive military campaign. All kinds of people died. It was just horrendous. And at some point, he woke up and he said, oh my God, what did I just do? And he flipped over. He became a Dharma practitioner. Is really the reason why the Dharma is available to us is because of King Ashoka. He put these pillars all through India where the Buddha was born and awakened and died and first taught and brought the Dharma to Sri Lanka. Did all this stuff that sort of brought Dharma into consciousness. He supported it, but he had been this terrible despot. So, this is an exercise, you know, without naming. Imagine someone you find difficult, politically maybe, or, you know, family member, whatever. This person may seem appalling. We may think they're just warped. But where is that intrinsically evil person? If we look with Dharma eyes, there is no such being. There just isn't. And the more we do our practice, the more we cultivate compassion, the more we bring insight, we'll see there is no such being. And then we won't suffer in the same way. Look at those five beings I mentioned. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela. They didn't suffer like many of us do, being caught by fear and division. They didn't. They just did all. They did something. It's pretty extraordinary what they did. So remember, the Buddha taught not self. There's no inherent self, one of the three characteristics. Therefore, there's no intrinsic being to hate. And that's a doorway to experiencing happiness in 2025. It really is, because we can just unwind this division. Yes, everyone talks about the division. I think I'm glad they do. You know, these political divisions, these oppositions. That's terrible. Tears this country apart. We don't have to. And, you know, start here. Start in your heart. That's how we can undo that. And, oh, by the way, we'll be happier for doing it. So that's kind of the doorway to loving kindness and compassion toward all beings, is seeing their potential to awakening. And seeing that we're all in this together, there's no separation. So how could it be other than compassion. How could we think other than that if we're all the same? So this is a way we can train ourselves, cultivate our minds, and communicate this with our friends and neighbors, that everybody has this potential to awaken, however we frame it, but just, you know, holding that vision. And it can really help us not be stuck in polarization. I'm almost done here. So you look at the Metta Sutta, one of the simplest, most beloved suttas in the Pali Canon, talking about metta, loving kindness practice. But when you start to look at it more deeply from this context, it gets a lot more radical. He says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart one should cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Notice he said none about five times. You know, every sentient being, whatever political person, Adolf Hitler, I'm refraining from naming anyone in 2025, but, you know, whatever that being is, do what the Buddha said. And it's just in that loving kindness, recognizing the conditioned nature of all awakened beings, which is therefore recognizing the potential of all awakened beings to awaken, to beings to awaken, we can move past these polarities. And this is tied in, you know, I started off with talking about pain and suffering. This is tied in with that because we suffer, because we're stuck, because we don't see this possibility, because we identify, we cling. We cling to niceness. We cling to things being the way we want them to be. But when we just see how they are, first noble truth, you know, unawakened life is unsatisfactory. To see how it is, then we're in a place where we can start to bridge the gap and embody compassion and live more happily. So it's just there. We can see with the eyes of the Buddha. There are no enemies. There are no enemies. There are only beings who have not yet awakened. That's it. And we haven't. At least I haven't. Maybe you all have. But we, you know, that's all there is. And then we can see there's nothing to fear, nobody to hate, just a universe of sentient beings with the potential to awaken. How cool is that? Let's sit for a second.